Minnesota Reads is produced at KUMD with funding provided in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. This morning, we're welcoming Leif Enger into our studios, and it's not often that we get a broadcast professional as a guest on this program, or somebody I went to college with, even though I didn't know it, or an author that I discovered not as an interviewer, but as a reader and fell in love with. So if I'm a little fangirl, you're going to have to just kind of overlook that a little bit. And you're a Duluth resident now, Leif.
I am. It was fun to hear from you, Lisa, and just walk up the hill this morning. And here we are.
And say, here, do a little radio. And you looked at our board here at KUMD and you said, I worked on that board.
Oh, absolutely. I love this equipment. I feel right at home.
It's older. No, it's vintage.
It's vintage, which means it's cool again.
Exactly. So your new book, Virgil Wander, is a marvelous story about a small town dude who lives a quote-unquote small town life until something kind of extraordinary happens to him. And I think it's more a way of taking the little gems of our everyday lives and polishing them up and putting them under the right light. And so they sparkle and we didn't realize, wow, that's sparkly.
That's kind of a great description of what it is, because what happens to Virgil is he has an encounter with death. He goes off the road into Lake Superior and has a traumatic head injury. And what happens to him is basically that. It's not that there's so much drama in Virgil's small town life. It's that he sees that life through new lenses.
He talks about himself. It's fascinating. I love the way you do it because it's so quick, easy, and yet perfect. He talks about himself as the previous resident.
Yeah.
When he talks about the person that he was before the accident,
right.
He says, well, the previous resident would have thought this or said this or done this,
yeah.
And yet he looks at things differently,
There's a before and after for Virgil.
Definitely.
Everything hinges. The hinge event in his life was that car accident. And it was great fun to write about a man who rediscovers his everyday and kind of quotidian life. Day by day, new things are uncovered, new attitudes, new language. He loses his adjectives in the accident, and his rediscovery of his adjectives is in some way a stand-in for a rediscovery of a lot of things in his life.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, if you lose the words you use to describe things, perhaps if they came back, you would describe them differently.
Maybe you would, or at least you would take your time deciding which adjective to use.
Which he has to do, in essence, because he has to. So I had read one of your previous novels and loved it, and so I was excited at the idea that you were up here and that it was going to be possible for you to talk a little bit. I asked you in an email if you have ever found yourself reading other authors' work or reading anything and running across a sentence that for whatever reason you wanted to copy down and keep. You wanted to remember.
Yeah. That has happened many times, but I never write them down. And the reason is that when we were in college, there was a terrific young writer named Epstein, and he published a debut novel. I want to say he was in his early 20s, and he published a novel called Wild Oats, which was about a kid going to college and, you know, basically sowing his wild oats. It was hilarious. It was a coming of age novel. I remember it fondly. About 6 months after I read it, Epstein was in the news again because he had plagiarized. Plagiarized a book called The Rachel Papers by Martin Amis, who's also a wonderful novelist. And what he said when he was confronted with his plagiarism was that he had read The Rachel Papers. He admired it so much that he kept a notebook of favorite phrases that he wrote down. And then he forgot that he had taken those phrases from an existing novel, and he used them in his book.
Got it.
And so I just took that as an object lesson. I just decided I'm going to admire many novelists, and I'm not going to copy down any of their, because I knew I would write someday.
Okay, so here's what you do. You take a picture of it.
Oh, but see, we didn't have these nifty
I realize that we
there.
Didn't. And I see. And I realize this because I wrote down a couple of sentences from your book that I really like. This one, burdens accrue in isolation. Pride, fear, stupidity, lassitude build up like layers of paint.
Yeah.
And it just seemed so. And this one I actually made a Facebook post out of. Why am I still surprised when it turns out there's more to the story?
Because there always is, you know.
That one is one that you that I
ask Epstein
would like to carry around with me because that happens to us so often when we jump to conclusions about people. You know, we're having a conversation and somebody does something that annoys us, for example, and then when we ask them about it, we find out that this is why they did the stupid thing, not because, as we thought, they were just trying to get on our last nerve.
Right, exactly. There's always a reason.
But
there's
that,
always more to the story.
Exactly. When you write something that beautifully encapsulates a thought or a feeling, and because you have none of this stuff written down, you have the sense that you are actually writing it, that it's actually you and it's not, you know, somebody else's. Do you notice it when you do it?
Oh, you know, after every paragraph, I never leave a paragraph until I'm pretty happy with the one I have.
So you don't do like a quick and dirty draft and then come back and start cleaning up and...
Well, I do a version of that, but I try not to leave too big of a mess on the page. At the end of the day, I like to know that what I did was will stand up. That being said, the next day I go back and rewrite. I'm a compulsive rewriter. That's, for me, where the real joy of the process is. And sometimes I feel like, oh, that's a good sentence. But, you know, not all that often. I mean, actually, my first draft sentences before I go back an hour later and try to fix them are very poor, very messy. And most of making a good sentence for me is to write a bad sentence first. And then go back and just remove words until it starts to be clean. It doesn't have to be eloquent. It just has to be clean.
Right.
And clean will do it most of the time. You were mentioning before we came on the air about the frustration of reading things online, for example, that have not been proofread, that maybe spell check hasn't done the job. And that's something that there are people like us, Lisa, who are bothered by that.
A lot.
And so when you read something that is clean, you say, okay, I'm in good hands. I can trust this writer.
Exactly. And that sense of trust, I think, is so important because when you find those errors, whether it's in an advertising flyer or we kind of expect them in instruction manuals now, but, you know, wherever it might be, I always have the sense that there's sloppiness going on, that whoever is not as concerned with me as they, you know, as a customer or whatever, as they need to be. And then if this sort of sloppiness extends into, you know, the way they're going to fix my car, I mean, I'll worry about that sort of thing.
Right.
You know, how can I trust you to fix my car when you don't even proofread?
We didn't see this coming with the information revolution, did we?
No, don't think so.
There was all this talk about, I remember trying to get my head around the idea of the information superhighway back when the Clinton administration were talking about the info superhighway that's coming. And I'd think, I don't know what that means. But I didn't think it would mean shloads of misspellings in New York Times articles.
Right, exactly.
I didn't understand that was going to happen.
So tell me, we talked a lot, we talked a little bit about the importance of reading as a writer. I've always said that there's no way that in, you know, the X number of years, 12 years, whatever that we get of English classes or even in college, that we can learn all the words and all the ways to use words, and that I can't imagine how you can write or be good at the language if you don't read. But then I was teasing you and I was saying, you know, well, let me tell you a little bit the psychology about people up here in this part of the world. And what is the role, do you think, as a writer, of introspection and being an armchair psychologist? Because you can't write about people and their thoughts and their feelings and their motivations if you have not looked at them and studied them.
You know, I'm not sure how it works for other people. For me, certainly, writing is part of the thinking process. William Faulkner said a great thing, or I think it was maybe, who knows who it was. Somebody said, I never know what I believe until I read what I've written.
Right.
Which is such a, you know, it more than just sounds cool. That's actually the way that it works. You start out with a thought, or you start out with an idea for a character, and maybe the only thing you know is that it's a woman in her mid-30s, and she's done thus and such a thing for a living. She works at a gas station. You start to write about her, and the details emerge through the writing. Her psychology starts to come to you, and you realize what has hurt her in the past, what has made her happy in the past. What's the difference, and this is key, between what she thought she was going to get out of life and what she's actually gotten? But for me, I don't know any of that until I sit down and start to scratch it out either with a pen in a notebook or on a laptop. I just don't know. It emerges with the words from the tips of my fingers.
And yet, if you had never asked that question of anybody, if you had never met anybody in a store and thought, I wonder how your life is different than you thought, you wouldn't even think that, I mean, that information wouldn't be accessible to you.
No, and it's, I don't know that I've ever actually asked anyone that question since I stopped interviewing people for a living.
Right.
And that's one of those things that, you know how there's a question you always ask after the mic is off? That's the one that I sometimes ask.
Usually it's, when can we go and have coffee?
But... Right. Yeah, yeah.
That's a great question.
A great question also. But I think that, in a way, writing is how you interrogate a person or an issue, anything that you want to know about. You read a general interest essay by Anne Fadiman, who wrote a great essay collection, several great essay collections. And you get the idea that she just was curious, and she started exploring this aspect of a novel that she had read and enjoyed, and it turned into a big essay that's 20 or 30 pages of just gripping prose. And it led her down all kinds of rabbit holes. Writing is a great way to look into those rabbit holes that you've always wondered about and discover new ones that you didn't know you were curious about until you sat down to write.
And yet again, an interview is, I can ask a question that I don't know of you, and you are a different person, and you will obviously respond back to me. But if I'm writing, if I ask a question, you know, I mean, I'm asking a question in essence of myself. So if I don't have an answer, you have these answers. So they came from somewhere.
They came, yeah, where do they come from?
You've been paying attention. Don't deny it.
No, of course.
You've been paying attention.
You pay attention and you listen. A lot of it's just listening.
Eavesdropping? Listening?
Yes, exactly. To the way people speak and the way they answer questions and the way they develop opinions about things or fail to develop opinions about things. The way they jump from one subject to another. People are so fun to listen to. That's something I think I learned from a career in radio before I started writing fiction, was that people are really interesting. All kinds of people are really interesting to listen to. Everybody's got a story. Everybody's got sort of a big story, even if they think they only have a small one. We tend to live out epics, and that's something you learn when you're just sent out with a microphone in your early 20s before your brain is fully formed.
Exactly. And these are the things that, you know, it's a frightening thing to think that broadcasting shaped our brains when we were young and squishy. And yet,
here we are.
It's amazing.
It is.
So I promised, you know, this was really important. We were talking here at KUMD. We were talking about a lot of the things that we have coming up this summer. And, of course, Duluth Dylan Fest is a big deal. That's on everybody's mind. And so I need to find out from you, how did they get Bob Dylan to appear at their festival?
Up in Greenstone. Yeah, they finally got Bob to show up.
How'd they get him to do that?
I don't know the details, but I assume that this was the work of Anne Fandine.
Right.
She's a woman who knows how to get things done.
She didn't go to college with him? How did she know him again?
Well, actually, it was Lydia that had traded Christmas cards with Dylan for 30 years.
Okay, that was it.
And been to 27 concerts.
That was it. Okay.
But she wasn't able to get Dylan to come.
No.
Didn't respond to that. I'm not sure how Anne did it, but she is a woman who finds creative ways to do things, and I suspect it was her work.
I think you're going to need to get back out there and do a little bit more research, maybe a little essay, a small expose on this. Because, you know, there are folks that are pretty interested in getting Mr. Dylan to come to some of our festivals here in Duluth. And if he's willing to go to Greenstone.
Have you reached out?
No, I haven't. Maybe I should invite him to do an interview, and maybe after that.
I'm sure he'd do it, Lisa.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. I'll tell him, my close personal friend, Leif Enger, who said that you came to a festival, and he'd go, what the heck is going on? He'd say, man, Minnesota, I love them.
You talk about those two flat tires.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Well, we've, you know, it's been interesting. Not Minnesota Reads, MN90 has had some really great stories of Bob Dylan that they've shared on that little feature from Ampers, and it's been super fun. But he almost killed himself in a motorcycle accident, just barely missed the train. I think he was trying to beat the train.
I don't know this story.
Something that we learned in Fargo-Moorhead to never try to do.
Are you a Dylanologist?
No, I just listen to all the cool stuff that we have here on the radio, and it just informs my life view. What can I say? I've been sitting at a board like this, Leif, for so many years. So, all right, one more question. One more question. What's next?
I'm not going to talk about it too much.
I don't want you to get in trouble with anybody, but you kind of were, you know. I said, okay, there's this little community radio station, and they're struggling, but they're wonderful, and they've got big stories, and it's a great story. And you said, well, I'm kind of worried, man.
Well, I have a character in my mind. I don't have a story for him to fit into yet, but I'm sure that's on the way. The character always comes first. And I have a character who is a small radio producer, actually at an AM station. This is modeled on my own experience from 1983.
I'm saying no. Small stations don't have producers. Small stations just have reporters and anchors, and they're also station managers, and they are also part-time engineers.
See, I insisted on calling myself a producer because I was the only guy at the radio station that had a splicing block,
ooh,
which I went out and bought with my own money, and I almost got fired for it. Another story. I'll tell that one over coffee.
This is going to be good. So you've got it. But all right. So you've got this. You got this small town radio dude. And that's just all we know. He could be like a walk-on in the next book.
He could be a walk-on, or he could have the whole thing to himself. I'm not sure. I know it's a Lake Superior novel.
Okay.
That's all I know for sure, because just moving over here, we lived in the great wilds
of western Minnesota.
Well, we lived in Aiken, which is, central Minnesota. It's 90 miles away.
Yeah.
But when we made the move over here, it was like, oh, my, there's something in the steam off the lake. There is to see the lake is to want to live near it, and I feel very energized.
Do you have a porch deck that you can sit out on and watch the lake first thing in the morning?
We can't see the lake from our porch because our porch is on the first floor. But if we climb, we have a tall, skinny house.
Okay.
And if we climb to the third story and look out of the attic windows, we can see the lake. So we have a very seasonal lake view. It depends on what the trees are doing. Right now, we can still see it.
You need to just get up early and go wander down there with your coffee.
Often do.
Make you glad you did.
Yeah, it's real nice.
Leif, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
What a pleasure.
Been super duper fun, and really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks a lot.
Leif Enger is the author of Virgil Wanderer, and he joined us this morning as our guest for Minnesota Reads. Minnesota Reads is produced at KUMD with funding provided in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. KUMD is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by UMD's Catherine A. Martin Library, presenting the 31st Annual Northeastern Minnesota Book Awards, Thursday, May 23rd at Duluth's Northland Country Club. The celebration begins at 5 p.m. with a book fair and refreshments, followed by guest speaker Margie Preuss and the awards presentation starting at 6:30 p.m. The event is open to the public. More information is available at z.umn.edu/NEMBA.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey signed a bill Tuesday to address missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. It commissions a first-of-its-kind task force to study cases and find possible solutions. Data on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls is sparse, and no comprehensive study has been done in the state. Native women's advocates say domestic violence, human trafficking, and sex trade are contributing factors. The task force will recommend legislation and other measures. Similar efforts are underway in New Mexico and Nebraska. Savannah's Act was reintroduced in the U.S. House Tuesday. The new version of the bill creates law enforcement guidelines for responding to missing and murdered Native women cases. It also includes provisions for urban Indians. Savannah's Act was reintroduced in the Senate earlier this year. A bill to reaffirm the Mashpee Wampanoags Reservation in Massachusetts is scheduled to go before the U.S. House Wednesday. A vote on the bill and another Indian Country bill were delayed last week after a tweet from President Trump calling on Republicans to vote against the bill. In a message to tribal citizens last week, the tribe's chairman, Cedric Cromwell, said they're focused on successful passage of the bill despite detractors. The tribe has long sought to secure land after receiving federal recognition status more than a decade ago. A proposal to permanently establish November as Alaska Native Heritage Month has passed the Alaska State Legislature. The House bill is sponsored by the first-ever Tribal Affairs Committee and is the first piece of legislation by the committee to pass the legislature. November would celebrate, honor, and recognize Alaska Native tribes and culture. The bill now heads to the governor's desk for approval. Meanwhile, Alaska lawmakers are considering expanding a state park to include historic graves of Alaska Native people who died in a World War II internment camp. Jacob Resnick reports.
After the Japanese bombed Dutch Harbor in 1942, U.S. authorities forcibly evacuated more than 800 Unungan people from nine villages in the remote western islands ahead of the Japanese advance. University of Alaska Southeast anthropology professor Daniel Monteith says that inhabitants of the Pribilof Islands were interned in makeshift camps in Southeast Alaska.
290 from St. Paul, 190 from St. George were relocated to Funter Bay.
Funter Bay is a remote site on Admiralty Island, more than 1,000 miles away from the Pribilofs. The camp was a shuttered salmon cannery with few provisions and little heat. Martin Stepton told Alaska lawmakers that all four of his grandparents spent the war at Funter Bay in miserable conditions.
Even my grandma used to say, late into her late 90s, she would say things like, oh, I hope it never happens again.
Stepton was testifying in support of a bill to expand a state park to include a cemetery with 32 marked graves.
The value of protecting the social and historical significance of this land will cement the history for good, and we will never have to repeat this history again.
Bill sponsor, Representative Sarah Hannon, said the cemetery is already on state-owned land, but the Juneau Democrat said she wanted to ensure it would remain open to the public by adding it and surrounding lands to the nearby Funter Bay Marine Park.
The descendants of the families who were buried there, you know, had some real anxiety about whether they would always have access to be able to visit the graves of their family.
The House passed the bill 29-4. It now moves to the Alaska Senate, but it's unlikely to be considered before next year's legislative session. For National Native News, I'm Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Alaska.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the law offices of Sanofsky Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman.